1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic ABC Media
News
app.
I'm Chuck Sievertson. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he spoke with former President Trump Tuesday after Special Counsel Jack Smith informed Mr. Trump that he's the target of an investigation into efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
I hear from people who said, you know what? I never voted for President Trump, but I'm going to vote for him now based upon how he's getting treated.
McCarthy says he doesn't think former President Trump should be found criminally responsible for the January 6th Capitol riot. The Republican-led House Oversight Committee hearing from two IRS whistleblowers who claim Hunter Biden was given lenient treatment over his taxes. Supervisory Agent Gary Shapley.
Prosecutors instructed investigators not to ask about the big guy or dad when conducting interviews.
Last month, Hunter Biden agreed to a plea deal on tax fraud charges. Democrats call the hearing an exercise in futility. Three people suffering injuries from severe weather in North Carolina. A tornado in Nash County damaged the Pfizer plant. This is ABC News. China says its Navy ships are preparing for joint exercises with Russia's sea forces. Ukrainian President Zelensky says his government is working to find a corridor to export Ukrainian grain now that Russia is ending a deal that allowed exports in the Black Sea. Network TV schedules will look a lot different this fall.
NBC is playing musical chairs because of the writers and actors strikes. Law & Order and Law & Order SVU won't premiere this fall, being pushed back to next year, along with the three Chicago shows, Night Court, and the new John Cryer comedy, Extended Family. The gaps will be filled by extra hours of The Voice and a few shows NBC was able to finish, including the second half of the final season of Magnum PI. CBS made similar moves earlier this week, announcing it'll import Yellowstone over from Paramount Network, and ABC and Fox are going mostly reality-based. Jason Athenson, ABC News, Hollywood.
Time running out to get a Powerball ticket for tonight's drawing, a cash value of $516 million before taxes. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
For the Talk of Green Bay News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know.
There's been another phone scam in northeast Wisconsin, this time in Door County. Civic Media's Stuart J. Waddles reports.
Be on the lookout for phone calls from people claiming to be law enforcement. The Door County Sheriff's Office says they received complaints about scammers posing as deputies in an effort to extract money from people. There have been similar scams in Winnebago, Brown, and Marinette counties. Authorities say they'll never demand money over the phone, which includes cryptocurrency. If you do get a call like this, call your local law enforcement agency's non-emergency number right away. Stuart J. Waddles, Civic Media News.
If you're looking for some fun for the whole family this weekend, the 139th Outagamie County Fair opened today in Seymour and runs through Sunday, the 23rd. Admission is $5, but a season pass for $20 is also available. For a schedule of events and attractions, go to outagamiecountyfair.com. Pete Schwabe, WGBW 97.9 News.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans.
Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISVRAP. That's 833-947-8727. Or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
The Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope I don't get to the Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Crute. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
A guy named Bill out in Econowoc. Bill's got some thoughts on that.
Yeah, thanks for talking about what you're talking about right now. Your station, you raised the bar high for integrity. You are a community radio station, which means you look out for all the citizens in the state of Wisconsin.
Daily conversations about Wisconsin's latest headlines and stories. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, you know, when you look at these gas prices, and look, they have been high. The reality is, you know, corporate America has been gouging our eyes out for so long that you know, I think some of us have gotten used to it. But again, I want to see Congress do something on that front. But Jack from Wisconsin's got a couple of ideas. Before I go to our next guest, I want to get Jack in. Jack, what's on your mind? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, first of all, answer, I think, to rising gas prices is to make a serious commitment to electrics and electric vehicles and renewable resources. And the question, of course, most people will ask is, how do we do it? It's going to cost trillions. Well, it's already cost trillions in the climate disaster problem. And we can pay for this. We have the money. If we stop giving away billions and billions to oil companies in this thing called the depletion allowance, it's been characterized as the biggest tax break in history, and it probably is. I own stock in one of those oil companies, inherited from my dad, and the quantity of profits these guys are making is absolutely outrageous. They don't need a tax break. We could use that money to establish a series of, for example, electric vehicle recharging stations in each of the gasoline stations that are now on the interstates and, yeah, and other highways.
No, you're absolutely right. And I appreciate the thoughts, Jack. Thanks so much. Look, the reality is, as Jack pointed out, profits through the roof. And until we go after the fact that they are gouging us, nothing's going to change. To me, I keep coming back to that. You listen to their earnings calls. They're telling us they're happy where the price is. They're happy gouging consumers because they know we got to pay it. This is where alternatives, this is where public transit, this is where all of the other stuff should be all forward. Now, the question is, you know, we want those EV charging stations. We want that infrastructure. We want those battery plants. We want that manufacturing back. But are we doing it the right way? Look, I hate giving corporate subsidies to anyone. I understand in order to bring that stuff back, to make it here, we're going to have to subsidize it. But here to share some thoughts on, are we doing it the right way? And maybe there's a better way. I've asked my good friend Greg LeRoy to come talk with us. Greg is the executive director of Good Jobs First. GoodJobsFirst.org is the website. They've got a new piece out called Power Outage Will Heavily Subsidized Battery Factories Generate Substandard Jobs? Question we haven't really talked about much. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be with you, Rick.
So now looking at this, you know, look, I hate giving out these kind of subsidies and giving corporate America tax breaks as much as anybody. So are we giving too much? Are we sweetening it too much, or are we doing enough? What are your thoughts?
We think we've published two studies now looking at both EV battery factories just from the state and local subsidy level, and now the federal level provision of the Inflation Reduction Act called the 45X, the production tax credit code for manufacturing batteries. Here's the takeaway. We looked at five new battery plants that are about to come online, most of them joint ventures between the big three and Asian battery companies. And when you add up all the federal and state and local subsidies that we know of, and we can't find some of them, the total subsidies per job to these factories is between $2 and $7 million per job. And yet they want to pay below market wages, much less below union wages for these jobs. The value of the 45X credit is so big, it's going to give some factories more than $1 billion per year for years as the bill plays out, more than enough to build the darn factories and pay all the wage bills for those years. And yet and still they want to pay below market wages. That's just too much. And it's crazy that a plant that's already so massively subsidized by the feds is now also getting these massive, you know, billions in some cases, tax breaks from the states and local governments. There's got to be a rational ceasefire here and a way to make sure that we're not over-subsidizing something and not getting great jobs and permanent new manufacturing wealth for the nation out of this.
Yeah, I mean, what's frustrating to me is, you know, a lot of the jobs that left the country during the deindustrialization period, we paid the bill for them to leave, and now we're paying the bill for them to come back, which, look, you know, we're in a screwed situation one way or the other. The only way to get the supply chain back, the critical things that we need for the country is to invest in it. My problem is I don't know that we're going to get the kind of return that I would hope we would get. I don't know if there's language in it that some of this gets repaid. There's a lot to it, but I fear that as a country, we're kind of held hostage in this moment. What do you make of that argument that look, they're not coming back unless we fund this. This idea that corporate America is going to do what's in the best interest of the country is never going to happen. We've got to sweeten the pot. What's the argument there?
Well, look, the argument is 40 years old, right? 40 years ago, the U.S. House of Representatives passed so-called domestic content legislation saying that 75% of what you make in your auto fleet that you sell in the U.S. had to be made in America. The bill never got through the Senate. The Japanese automakers came in and built a bunch of early plants in union states in the north, you know, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, places like that, Indiana, and deflected the attempt to enact domestic content legislation here. Now we're basically bribing companies to put the domestic content, both in the EVs, right? You don't get the full consumer credit unless the batteries are made here. And the same is going to happen now with the microchip subsidies under the Chips and Science Act, $39 billion for bricks and mortar subsidies for semiconductor factories. We didn't have an industrial policy for so long. We've had this vacuum, and suddenly the Biden administration is rushing in. And we wish there was more strings attached. We wish there was more restraint. We wish there was better targeting. It's about time. Desperately, we needed industrial policy because Germany's always had industrial policy. Japan's always had industrial policy. Lord knows China's got an industrial policy. We've had this wide open, you know, laissez-faire policy all these years, and it really hurt us.
Now, you know, as I've been saying, you know, I think Biden has done a good thing. I think they're moving us in the right direction by obviously having a manufacturing policy that we haven't had for a very long time, maybe moving a little away from neoliberalism and the free trade stuff. But, you know, the subsidy stuff, I've always been a little hesitant, being 100% behind. And I do want the administration to push for more strings. So how do we as consumers, how do we as voters, you know, how do we push for these things? Because look, I think the administration would listen. I think the administration might move on this. Any thoughts?
Look, we're also very generally supportive of the thrust of these bills, the intent of these bills, and the, you know, long overdue idea that we must have an industrial policy in the United States. Right on to all that, and the Biden administration is overcoming so much inertia and so much misguided history. It's bound to get some things not quite exactly right, but the big picture is great. So we think two things should be happening right now. To the extent states or cities are also subsidizing these battery plants and other things, they're also getting all the federal money. the states can still attach a lot of strings to the deals. They can still say market-based wages. They can help take wages out of competition so it's easier for the UAW to organize. We want to do everything we can with public policy to lower employer resistance to organizing and make it easier for the UAW to reestablish greater density in the auto industry. Because in the long run, that's the real solution, right? And the other point is the chance for popular support for the union organizing. That needs to happen as well.
Yeah.
And the consumers using these things, right? When we make choices about which EVs to buy, we should be mindful of trying to buy those that are union built.
No, I'm right there with you. But for me, it comes back down to more policy. You know, we've created this environment of low taxes for the very wealthy, low taxes for corporate America. I'm of the mindset we dig up Dwight David Eisenhower, the good socialist president from the 50s. We bring his tax code back and we start taxing these people at an incredibly high rate. And I think you will then see, you know, more investment domestically. I think you will then see higher wages and money being spent a lot differently by corporations other than just lining their pockets and buying back shares and moving overseas. I could be wrong, but that's where I would want to start.
No, there's a saying I like very much, which says prosperous places tax the rich. And it's objectively true. And certainly, you know, by all the serious, you know, Nobel winning, you know, economists and so on, we need to make our tax system more progressive. We need to tax the rich at higher rates. We need to, frankly, help reduce the deficit long term that way. But all the other things that we need to catch up on, you know, repeal the Trump tax cuts, repeal the Bush tax cuts, tax carried interest, you know, tax hedge fund managers, like real income, not capital gains. There's so many big whopping federal loopholes in the tax code that would make a huge difference overnight and would not hurt the economy.
Yeah, because here's the thing, Greg. I mean, you know, I get people emailing and calling and saying, look, you know, gas prices are high, groceries are high, inflation's killing us. All of this stuff is hurting working families. All of this stuff, people are struggling. There's real pain, and I'm not dismissing that because, look, I'm one of those working people. I know what it's like to go to the grocery store and go, geez, that's more than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. But I'm looking at these corporate profits, man. I'm looking at these CEOs lining in their pockets, and I'm looking at this stuff going, this should be the target. We're heaping all of this reward upon them because, hey, we need these factories, we need these jobs. But there's a part of me that goes, you know, it's time to start talking about big picture stuff. It's time to see the elephant, man.
I agree. And obviously we've got two pinch points coming up with the UAW, with the master agreement, with the big three. Coming up at the end of September when it expires, and obviously the UPS contract with the Teamsters coming up at the expiring at the end of this month. Two big proving moments about whether unions can win better contracts and, you know, greater movement toward leveling the playing field and regaining density.
Now, I want to get your thoughts also, because like the CHIPS bill is subsidizing, you know, a massive amount of jobs, and you know, we are talking about, you know, bringing back manufacturing, which everyone agrees is a good thing. I think something we should have done years ago, should have never let manufacturing go. It was bad policy from the Reagan, the H.W. Bush, the Clinton years, the W. Bush years, and even Obama, all bad policy. And it's about time we're moving, and especially Trump, because Trump sold us on the idea he was going to bring it all back.
Right.
Didn't happen. So I give Biden credit where he deserves. I'm like we've talked about, I'm still a little uncomfortable. So, you know, how do we create a movement of folks who are going to, because I think the administration's willing to listen. I think I said this before. How do we create a movement of pushing in a direction to say we demand better?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for our part here at Good Jobs First, we're trying to follow the money. And the money is very instructive because, you know, we haven't had industrial policy. We've had this kind of, you know, race to the bottom, war among the states, you know, second war among the states. That was a phrase coined many decades ago by Business Week, because we just have, you know, state versus state. We don't have any federal policy guiding our manufacturing future. So we need to follow the money and talk about how there's too much money being put in too few baskets, you know, too many eggs in too few baskets. gold plating a small number of these massive battery or EV factories is not the safest way to spend the money. We need to spread the peanut butter more thinly and build more capacity, more skills base, more broad-based technology, more municipal broadband, all the things that make lots of things possible for lots of companies, and don't put us, you know, at the whim of, you know, General Motors and LG and Panasonic and Tesla.
No, it's an excellent point. Now, the president, you know, tweeted out today, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. And I got to tell you, he's not wrong.
I agree completely. Look, and we should also be supporting Lina Khan and her leadership at the Federal Trade Commission. She's under attack, obviously, now by the right-wing members of Congress. But, you know, fixing our antitrust policy, bringing our anti-monopoly laws into the 21st century to deal with digital technologies, we're way overdue. We're way behind the European Union. It's a matter of personal safety. It's a matter of saving democracy. It's a matter of saving entrepreneurship and small businesses. You know, it's SOS time on antitrust.
And restoring competition that the right used to tell us that they love so much. The website, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg Leroy is the executive director there at Good Jobs First. Highly suggest checking out the work that they do. Greg, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend Greg Leroy. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people of the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, yeah, you know, during the break, I'm thinking about, you know, the last couple of calls. And, you know, again, the Hunger Games scenario that working people are always put into. You know, and I've got a lot of Trump supporter friends who go, you know, gas prices were lower, food prices, inflation was lower. You know, the Trump economy was great. And you go, it was not bad. And thank you, Obama, for building that so Trump could take advantage of it. And, oh, by the way, thank you, Republicans, for giving rich people a whole bunch of money to heat up an economy by going further into debt. All the things that we're told we're not supposed to do, they did. And, you know, more tax breaks and more handouts and, you know, all kinds of stuff. This is one of these moments where you, again, had a Democrat taking over an economy that was in shambles. Clinton, you know, took over a poor economy from H.W. Bush. What Obama got from Bush. I mean, really? We going to call that an economy? We're on the verge of massive depression. And then what Biden took over, really in the midst of a potential depression, a supply chain that's horribly broken, corporate America, it's all about them and the gouging. And nobody really, you know, I keep saying, where's this generation's Harry Truman? You know, when are we going to start holding, you know, hearings on gouging and what corporate America did to us during the pandemic and throughout these years? The Groundwork Collaborative has done an incredible job of listening to those earnings calls. And all of the oil companies, they were bragging by the fact that they are making record profits and not drilling. They're happy with the production level. They could ramp up production. We've got the capacity for it. They're just not going to. Now you throw in all of the other external problems that have popped up, you know, Russia deciding they want to take over Ukraine. And whatever your feelings on that is, we've got to support Ukraine, because you don't want Russia feeling that they can just, you know, steamroll over people. But that has caused a massive inflation in fuel costs. You know, I remember a time, and I guess it's just because I'm a little bit older, I remember a time where patriotism meant something. You know, I know corporate America loves waving the flag, but they don't do anything to help working people. And this is where I come back to. The answer to a lot of our problems, and nobody wants to hear this, because for a couple of generations now, we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to anytime we hear tax increases, to lose our ever-loving flipping minds. And because, again, when we hear taxes, they're going to raise taxes on us, because that's what they've done. You know, they've said, we're going to give all these great tax breaks. And what happens? The working class takes it on the chin. The working class takes it on the chin all the time. And look, are the Democrats perfect? No, not by any stretch of the imagination. I would love to see much more progressive, much more liberal, much more working class centric Democrats. People like me, who know what it's like to struggle to make a house payment or put food on the table. People who have missed a meal or two. That's what I want in the halls of power. So for me, it comes back to the tax code. And when you talk about increasing taxes on people, you talk about who has the money. You know, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, you know, they pay 30% of all the taxes. Yes, because they're hoarding all of the wealth. When you have, you know, three people who have more wealth than, you know, half the bottom half of the country, that's a problem in distribution. Jesse the Body Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, said it so perfectly. There should never be a billionaire. We should tax them out of existence. And I go back to that magical era of the 50s, where we had a top marginal tax rate of 92%. To where at the very top, that dollar over whatever the number was, I think back then it was $200,000, that dollar over $200,000 in 1953 money, which I think is about $1.6 million in today's dollars. But that dollar was taxed at 92%. And I've said before, I would love to have paid that tax rate because it meant I was making a huge amount of money. But as far as a society goes, you cannot have a handful of uber wealthy people making policy outside of this self-governance model that we have. You can't have massive corporations that decide that more for them and less for everybody else. You know, the reason the GM era worked so well is you had strong unions who demanded wage increases. You had high taxes, so the CEOs would never think of taking $20, $30, $50, $100 million. It would have never dawned on them. Because one, they'd have had to sit across from the union and justify it, because the unions would certainly want higher wages, which they should. But it was also, it was going to get taxed away from them. This is why I keep coming back to the single issue, if I could change any of it, would be a massive tax increase on the very wealthy. And like they had back during the Eisenhower years, 100 tax brackets, to where the more you earned, the higher you paid. That's the price of admission in this society. But again, we've been told as working people, no, we can't tax them. They're the job creators. We give them all this money because they know what to do with it. And they do. They know what to do with it. They make themselves wealthier. In this era of Reaganomics, have working people gotten that much better off? The answer is no. We're much more health insecure. We're much more retirement insecure. We're much worse off than we were 40 years ago as a working class. So for me, it comes back down to the policy and the people that we put in the power. Now, it's interesting. When AOC set a 40% rate on people making over $10 million a year, oh boy, the right lost their mind. I would be worse than that. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that President Bill Clinton announced his Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He had campaigned for president, promising to allow all citizens to serve in the military, regardless of sexual orientation. Once he was elected, there was a great deal of opposition to his proposal. Military officials railed against the idea of lifting the ban on homosexuals in the military. Members of Congress and the public voiced opposition. President Clinton proposed a compromise he called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This meant that military officials were not supposed to inquire about the sexual orientation of servicemen and women. Service members were not to be public about their sexual preference. This meant that if members of the LGBT community wanted to pursue a career in the military, they had to hide a significant part of who they were or risk losing their jobs. The policy stood in effect for nearly two decades. More than 12,000 officers lost their jobs because they refused to stay in the closet. It is also unknown how many more LGBT people decided not to apply for military service because of the discriminatory division. President Obama pledged to repeal the policy during his first election. It took 2 years after his election until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was finally ended by Congress. Some members of Congress issued dire warnings about repealing the discriminatory policy. But on the fifth anniversary of the repeal, President Obama issued this statement. Today, Americans can serve the country they love, no matter who they love. And openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual men and women in uniform make our military stronger and America safer. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Unfortunately, it's 1984 again in America, not the year, the book. George Orwell's classic novel tells of a far-right totalitarian clique that uses newspeak and doublethink to impose their rigid anti-democratic doctrine on society. Their regime held power through mind control. They had a ministry of truth for perverting language and manipulating facts, while their thought police enforced ideological purity and suppressed dissent. 39 years later, here comes a clique of theocratic extremists in our country, using Orwellian manipulation in its crusade to take control over every woman's personal reproductive rights. Having seized the Supreme Court and practically the entire Republican Party, these present-day autocrats are now demanding that state and national lawmakers enforce the group's ultimate dictate, a total ban on abortions, even in cases of rape and incest. To their amazement, however, the great majority of Americans, even Republicans, think abortion ought to be generally available, with each woman deciding what's best for her. Moreover, the idea of Big Brother imposing a federal ban is massively unpopular. No problem, say today's Orwellian news speakers. We'll just ban the word ban from our PR campaigns. Thus, their harsh abortion ban has magically morphed linguistically into, quote, a pro-life plan. There. Feel better? The abortion truth twisters are even plotting to ban reporters from using the word, claiming that it will be considered proof of political bias. Sure enough, rather than risk right-wing fury, some scaredy-cat reporters are already caving in, meekly describing bans as, quote, restrictions on procedures. How nice, a kinder, gentler tyranny. This is Jim Hightower saying, to keep up with today's Orwellian thought police, connect with Jessica Valenti's diligent tracking of anti-abortion trickery at jessica.substack.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. and take your calls the rest of the hour. I got an email from Jay. Jay says, we pay enough in taxes. I'm tired of you tax and spend liberals. Always wanting to spend my money. Socialism never works. Not talking about socialism. I'm talking about allocation of resources to best help a society move forward. I go back to, I wouldn't have called my grandparents socialists. I mean, they did fight fascism overseas, and they did come home and build the strongest, most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And how did they do it? You know, this isn't difficult. You can look back to what happened. They came back to the shop floor. They fought for a share of the profit that their wealth created. And if you look at the graphs that are out there from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, productivity went up, wages kept pace. So the better trained work, the more productive, the meritocracy we're told is supposed to exist, the more people did, the more they got paid. As productivity increased through, you know, efficiencies, through technology, through whatever, workers benefited from that. They shared in it. Sometime around the middle 70s, productivity continued, you know, 45 degree angle, straight across, straight up. Wages deadlined. What happened? Well, an all-out assault on working class people. An assault on the social safety net. An assault on working families. That's what it was. Policies brought by conservative Democrats and conservative neoliberals. You call them what you want. The Reaganites. All of these pro-corporatists. Understand, the guy who wrote the Powell memo, Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, was a moderate Democrat. Wrote that you need to break up unions. Wrote that you need to take over media. Wrote that you need to take over education. You need to train people to believe in free enterprise. And they've done a masterful job. Because I've had these conversations with hundreds of people. We're a capitalist system and corporate America, they know best. And I get tagged with this tax and spend liberal, which you know, I fully accept. I am a tax and spend liberal. I want to tax the very wealthy, the people who have the money, and I want to spend it on the things that we need. Infrastructure, healthcare, education, you know, you name it. The things that we, military, the things that we as a society need and demand. You got to pay for it. As opposed to my conservative friends who are like, no, we'll spend crazy amounts of money enriching the very wealthy, and of course doing some of the bare minimums that we have to, and we'll just slap the credit card on it. You go, but we're $32 trillion in debt. And yeah, you know how we got there? We got there because we kept telling the American people that we could cut taxes on the people who have all the money and give them more and create a larger wealth class. And it wasn't going to, it was actually going to be good. It's going to be better. We were going to bring in more money. It was going to be fabulous. It was going to be utopia. It was going to be rivers of gold and honey, manna from heaven. And what do we end up with? Well, we end up with some $32 trillion in debt. Intergenerational debt brought on by making sure that corporate America and the very wealthy do well better. And this is where, you know, Jay, I'm tired of simplistic, that socialist. Government investments. It's how the country ran in the 50s. Massive infrastructure bill. The Eisenhower years saw massive investment in infrastructure. Now, granted, we had to sell it as, you know, it's military. It's going to help us keep us safe. And maybe we can do that again. You know, housing, you know, our veterans. You know, we got to keep our veterans, you know, safe and well-heeled and all that because we might need them again. Those children, maybe they shouldn't go to bed hungry. Because we might need them to fight war. Maybe that's how we have to do it. Because understand, virtually every one of these programs is because of some kind of tie to the military. The first milk program, the first school milk program was put into place because, well, kids coming out of school weren't strong enough to carry the weapons. They were malnourished. So as I look at where we're heading, we have the haves and the have-nots. I go back to John Edwards in 2004 talking about the two Americas. I talk to my friends with the Patriotic Millionaires. They say the same thing. It's their greatest fear. You don't get millionaires reaching into their pockets saying, you know, we want to be taxed higher. We want all these investments. If there's not some bit of fear that heads will be on platters at some point. And this is the frustrating part of this. And look, I hate paying taxes as much as the next person. But it's the price of admission. And as I've always said, you know, if you don't like paying taxes to our country, if you do not like paying taxes for the things that we as citizens want, need, and demand, you can leave and not benefit from the infrastructure, not benefit from the environment that we have. You can go. This is the part that drives me insane. Because with smart policy, we can go back to having that prosperous working class. You know, the gas price thing always comes up. You know, I'm paying out the nose for gas. And as I started the show off today, for the first time in 2 years, wages have outpaced inflation. If we had stronger unions, walk with me on this because this is important. If we had stronger unions, if we had 25, 30% union density like we had in the 70s and 80s, and wages had, oh, I don't know, kept up. I go back to my grandfather, 1975, he got three raises because the union contract said, hey, we're not going to allow our wages to get eroded by inflation. Had you had that, I don't know, maybe the cost at the pump wouldn't hurt as much. But what we've had is no ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, no ability for our wages to keep up and our standard of living to not be eroded and destroyed. Maybe this is the way forward. Maybe the way forward. Want to hear your thoughts. Let's go to the phones. Got Lewis on line one in New Jersey. Lewis from New Jersey. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Rick?
Hit me.
Yeah, I'm calling because, one, I want to say I totally agree with everything that you're saying tonight. And secondly, I'm also very frustrated when I hear callers who claim to be Democrats just do what you're saying we should not do, right? Which is we should not give the opponent any opening to justify their harmful policy. The Democrats are doing something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When you ask the question about what has the GOP done, the gentleman couldn't answer it because they have done nothing for the last decade or more. And I just want to say something else, too, in regards to what you were just talking about. What people don't understand is, in a way, this country has practiced socialism. You know, you can think of the New Deal as socialism light, but we can also think of the ways in which this government gives out handouts to industries. And the only thing they don't do is just take them over, but they let these industries go wild, and then we got to pay the price for it. And people need to understand what you're saying is what is going to get us out of this mess. Tax the rich. They have not paid their fair share. They need to. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Strengthen the labor movement, because if you're not being able to meet your expenses, then that says, hey, what can we do as a working class to get more for what we're producing? You see? So I'm totally with you tonight, Rick. And that's all I wanted to say.
Appreciate it, Lewis. Appreciate the call. Good stuff. Thanks so much. No, I mean, you know, and look, I'm not going to beat up on Chad for over the comments, because look, I understand people are frustrated. I understand people are angry. And what people keep hearing, what keeps... Because the right-wing echo chamber is so powerful, is it's all Biden's fault. It's Bidenflation. Biden did that. We got stickers all over the place. I understand. I understand the anger. I understand the frustration. I do. The problem is what they're feeding us is nothing but outrage. It's nothing but division. They don't have a policy. they don't have a way forward. There's nothing. All we get from the Marjorie train wrecks and the Gates and the gun fetish Barbies is more outrage-tainment. More gimmick, more circus. Where's the policy? And I've been asking this. I've been doing this show 18 years now. This is been my activism, my passion. I've been doing this all these years, and I keep asking the same question. What is it Republicans have done solely that has helped the working class? What policy have they dreamt up? What policy have they brought forth, debated, passed, and gotten signed into law that helps working people? Certainly nothing on minimum wage. Certainly nothing on getting people the ability to make organizing easier. Certainly not a social safety net. They've tattered and destroyed that. What policies have they moved forward other than tax cuts that never seem to trickle down? And when we do get a tax cut in the working class, what ends up happening is they find another way to get it from us. I look at Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was the governor of Massachusetts for a number of years, and Mitt Romney never raised taxes. He'll be the first one to say, I never raised taxes on working people. But he did fee the you-know-what out of everyone. In fact, 500 times during his tenure, during his 8 years, 500 times they raised fees. So that hunting license that you love so much, that kept going up. Your driver's license fee, that kept going up. Your car registration, that kept going up. Permits to cut your grass, that kept going up. Everything that you got from your government kept going up. And they do that because it's a double win. It's a double win. They don't have to raise taxes. They can bring in revenue. And it makes you really angry that you're getting nickeled and dimed and fleeced at every opportunity. Look, they know what they're doing. They want you to hate our government. And they're really successful at it. You know, government can't do anything, shouldn't do anything, should be small enough we can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. And then they go about showing us how bad government can be run. And then they go, look, it doesn't work. And they've got a massive infrastructure that they've invested in over 40 years to tell you, see, it doesn't work. Told you it wasn't going to work. Didn't work. I look at where we are in this moment. And if the working class of this country could unite around the simple idea that we should be doing better, that our hours that we trade for dollars are worth more, that policy should help us. You know, I go back to my high school government teacher. Government decides who gets what. The reality is the wealthy have gotten everything that they want. Corporate America gets what they want. Why? They lobby heavily. They spend lots of money. The minimum wage in this country is still $7.25 an hour. What's it been, 13 years since it's last been raised? Totally eroded by inflation. And I know everyone goes, but Rick, you know, no one's paying that. Not yet. And if that's the case, if no one's paying it, raising the minimum wage should not be a problem. Should be a no-brainer. If everyone's paying $15 an hour, shouldn't that be where the no-brainer idea goes? Yeah, raise the $15 an hour. Everyone's paying it anyway. They won't do that. Never. Because again, they've told us repeatedly, and if you listen to what Republicans say, they're very honest. You got to give them credit. You just got to listen. You know, they don't believe there should be a minimum wage. If you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work for a buck an hour, 100 hours a week, no overtime, that's your right. It should be your freedom. It should be your liberty. This is why they keep feeding us all this outrage. It's got to be what keeps you angry. Why aren't we angry that gas prices are higher and demanding? Now, we're going to drill. Okay, we're going to drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill. Understand, the oil companies are sitting on thousands of leases. In fact, you know, like Biden, much to the chagrin of the environmentalist community, has opened up a portion of Alaska. There's going to be more drill baby drilling there. It's going to happen. And look, I'm an environmentalist. I'm telling you, we're not ever getting off of the dirty stuff. The renewables that are coming hopefully will bring down our dependence on the other stuff and make us less dependent and less, well, fleeceable, if you will. But I got questions and problems with the other side as well. Are we going to go on all EVs, and what's going to happen to the electric prices? You know what I would love to see? I'd love to see a policy that makes every home energy independent. Solar panels, geothermal, you name it. So that you plug in your car, you're off the grid, you're producing what you need. You know why that'll never happen? Because corporate America can't profit from it. But I don't hear anyone talking about those ideas. No. It's all about ensuring corporate profits, because we've been trained like that. Anything else, that would be socialism. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1848. That was the day the Convention on Women's Rights began in Seneca Falls, New York. The organizers of this convention brought together some of the leading women's activists of the day, such as Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucretia Mott. The meeting included numerous discussions on the role of women in society. Leaders presented a declaration of sentiments. It included a list of oppressions faced by women of the day. Several had to do with work and economic issues. For example, it noted that men monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, while women could earn only a scanty remuneration. It also declared, "He closes against her all the avenues of wealth and distinction, which he considers most honorable to himself. As a teacher of theology, medicine, or law, she is not known." Despite these limitations, many women, poor women in particular, were forced by economic necessity to work. By 1840, 8,000 women and girls as young as 13 worked in the New England textile mills. Women almost always earned far less than men. Female textile mill workers in Massachusetts had formed the first union of working women in the United States, the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association. Of course, the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention provoked scorn and outrage from many, especially men. A local newspaper wrote, "This bolt is the most shocking and unnatural incident ever recorded in the history of humanity. If our ladies will insist on voting and legislating, where, gentlemen, will be our dinners and our elbows? Where are domestic firesides and the holes in our stockings?" Even today, women still earn less than men. For every dollar men earn, women only earn 78 cents. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. TheRickSmithShow.com. I want to go through a couple of things that I think the Biden administration doing well. It's things that don't get any attention whatsoever, but it's our tax dollars at work. It's what's helping working people. And again, this is the stuff that it doesn't make the news. It's not sexy. It's not something that people run campaigns on. But the reality is, OSHA has reissued some record-keeping rules to ensure that workers that are seriously injured, maybe we start looking into. If you remember, during the Obama years, they had issued an improvement to the record-keeping rule requiring large establishments to send OSHA information about every serious worker injury. Trump did away with all that. Now, when they say, you know, these are places of 100 or more employees, that's coming back because we should have the kind of data to make sure that workplaces are safer. Also, MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, has also proposed a standard to protect miners from deadly silica dust. You may remember during the Trump years, one of the first executive orders that Trump railed out was, you know, deregulating, you know, some of that dust stuff, the silica, the barium, this, you know, some of that stuff that, yeah, you know, a little won't hurt you. This is coming back, and I think that's a good thing. There is also a proposal to act on protecting workers from heat and smoke. You know, over the last couple of weeks here where I live, Canada's killing us. The air quality, not great. The heat in places like Texas, not good and going to get worse. We need to get ahead of policy to protect working people on the job. Now, understand, you know, as a union guy, this is stuff that you will sit down and you will negotiate over. And we're seeing this in the UPS contract. The fact that they don't have air conditioning in the truck, one of the things that they fought for and have tentatively won, that's a big deal. The fact that they're talking about temperature and ensuring that, you know, their members, those Teamster members, don't die on the job or pass out, kind of an important thing. Maybe having a law, also not a bad idea. This is one of those things where I've not talked about on the show often, but I've always wondered about. Evidently, they're also, OSHA is also looking at somehow to protect women who are real estate agents. I mean, you stop and you think about it. These women go into these houses with who knows who. Alone most of the time, and vulnerable. They're saying, look, you know, the fact that these are independent contractors means they don't have protection under you know, what is it, Title VII or OSHA. There's something has to be done. This is a start to move in a good direction. At least that's my thought. Also, OSHA has announced a program to protect warehouse workers. There are some, 2 million people who work in warehouses now. And, you know, you look at Amazon and the fact that they're at the top of all of the negatives for injury rates and you know, ergonomic stuff. There should be some laws in place to protect people. Now, again, this is where me as a union guy have always said in the past, this is why we have unions. Wages, hours, conditions. Sadly, we're in a moment where 6.6% of the private sector workforce is unionized, and our laws are so badly broken that it's really hard for people to organize, especially when you're looking at, you know, these big behemoths like Amazon. You know, Staten Island, the Amazon facility there. When was that election? What, 2 years ago now? Longer? I don't even remember how long ago it was. They still don't have a contract because, well, our laws are that badly broken. Whereas, you know, in any functional system, those folks would have a contract. They would have the ability to negotiate over the conditions of that warehouse and make things better. They don't now. So this is why they're saying that OSHA should do something. They've launched a national emphasis program, and it's going to look at warehouse workers and figure out how to, well, make lives better. And for me, this is what government is supposed to do. Look, this is why I'm a fan of President Biden. I think they're putting people into places that are going to help working people. I go back to the Trump years, and, you know, and I've just read through some things that they're making better. During the Trump years, I was probably sitting here telling you all of the things that they're deregulating and making worse. So for me, we're in a moment where it's not that difficult to decide which side you're on. And I know, you know, things, it's a struggle for a lot of folks. I get it. But this is why we make work pay. This is why we fight for a better future. And I look at the party who's trying to do that, and it ain't my Republican friends. Wish they were, but they're not. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media News app.